The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers. The first to speak on the fifth tradition, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker, who will speak for 30 minutes. Tonight, we will have a 30-minute... Sorry about that. Tonight, we will have a 30-minute informational meeting directly following the main speaker. We will hear brief reports from our intergroup reps, general service reps, and our corrections and treatment chairs to learn more about AA service below the group level. All are encouraged to stay, but may leave after the main speaker if need be. Our first 10-minute speaker speaking on the fifth tradition is Marsha.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Marsha, and I'm an alcoholic. And I've been asked to let you know my home group is the Trinity Group. We meet on Tuesdays and Fridays at 87th and 1st. And I've also been asked to let you meet, my sobriety date is November 2nd, 1989. And I've been asked to let you know that I'm your group relations chair on the New York Intergroup Steering Committee. And I used to be your chair on the steering committee several years ago. So I'm grateful that you all gave me the opportunity to do this service. So thank you. Thank you for all of that. It really, really kept me sober. It keeps me sober. I am supposed to read the long form of the Tradition 5, and that is, I came with props, of course. The long form, I think this is like the shortest one in the whole book. Each Alcoholics Anonymous group ought to be a spiritual entity, having but one primary purpose, that of carrying its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. I love that it's so short. I mean, it's like right to the point. Like, I'm here for a reason, and I'm here to stop drinking and to make sure that I help the next alcoholic. There's not like a whole bunch of wiggle room in there. And for me as an alcoholic, you know, I couldn't stop drinking. I always say I drank in a crystal glass because they said if you drank in a crystal glass, you couldn't be an alcoholic. And I always wanted to have a lot of wiggle room. I wanted a lot of wiggle room in everything. And if there was enough wiggle room, I could sort of negotiate it and never have to do it. And this long form is like there is no wiggle room. The other thing I like, if I may, is there's just a couple sentences from our conference-approved literature. It's our 12 and 12 step book under Tradition 5. And it starts out with, "Shoemaker, stick to thy last. Better do one thing supremely well than many badly." That is the central theme of this tradition. Around it, our society gathers in unity. The very life of our fellowship requires the preservation of this principle. There is another reason for this signalness of purpose. It is the great paradox of AA, that we know we can seldom keep the precious gift of sobriety unless we give it away. If we neglect those who are still sick, there is unremitting danger to our own lives and sanity. I don't know, that just gives me chills, you know, that my job, you know, when I was new and I was coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, my sponsor would say to me after each meeting, you know, "Marsha, did you go up and talk to the new woman who was in the meeting?" And I'd say, no, I didn't. And she'd say, "Oh, but that's what we do. We walk up and you see that person over there? She's visiting. You know, we walk up and we welcome them." And I was like, "But I thought you were supposed to welcome me. I'm new." And, isn't that it? You know, this tradition really tells me that I'm supposed to stop thinking about myself, the self-centeredness of the alcoholic, and that, you know, my job is to make sure that I'm helping another alcoholic, no matter how much time I have here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so when I came, you know, they said, "Sit down, turn to your left, turn to your right, and introduce yourself." And they said to me, "You know, you're going to be surprised when you do that, how you're going to help the next sick and suffering alcoholic." I was taught to attend my home group's business meetings. I would tell you that has kept me so sober here in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, they said, "Marsha, Alcoholics Anonymous, if you follow us and you follow our way, which is the 12 steps and the 12 traditions and, you know, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous," they said, "I promise you, I promise you, you will learn to fit in society, and you'll be a member of society without having to pick up a drink. And you'll learn how to live life on life's terms. And so they said, so start going to the business meetings. And so my home group, you know, was such that we met once a month, and we had these business meetings. And, you know, and through the years, I've always attended my AA home group's business meetings. And, you know, there's always at some point a conversation about, in fact, my home group just had this several months ago, are we doing enough to help the sick and suffering alcoholic? What are we doing to help the newcomer? What are we doing from an outreach standpoint to do outreach in our community to help that sick and suffering alcoholic? I think it's great here. You know, it's an open meeting, and you read that section on if you have other problems with alcohol, there's a plate, you know, you give ideas, you know, on how to help. But, you know, we have a singleness of purpose here. I also like, you know, when I was reading some of the different literature, the one AA Comes of Age, it talks about how we are in cooperation with our religious and medical community, that we're not here to compete with our religious and medical community as relates to a singleness of purpose to help the sick and suffering alcoholic, but that we have different roles. You know, the medical field helps the medical side. The psychiatric field helps the psychiatric side. But we help the alcoholic from the 12 steps and the 12 traditions by passing on my experience to you. There's just no other way that I know of to stay sober. I'm going to tell you, I'm going to listen to you a lot quicker than I would ever listen to a doctor. Doctor told me, yeah, you know, you're drinking too much. I really didn't care. You know, but I could never con you. I just couldn't con a con, you know. I just couldn't con you. And so working with the sick and suffering alcoholic, you know, that's our primary job. That's our primary purpose. Now, we still can have fun. We can still have dances. We can still have events. But that's not our primary purpose. It's still to keep helping the alcoholic. In my role as group relations, my role that I was elected for from your intergroup delegates is to make sure that the meeting book is updated. So I borrowed your meeting book. I promised them I'd give it back. But the AA meeting book or the new AA meeting finder online, or as you might notice, thanks to Michael B., who's one of your home group people, we've also got a new website that New York Intergroup website that went live last Monday. But my responsibility is to work with people that are willing to do service. I'm hoping some of you might be. And we have 1,430 groups here in the five boroughs of New York City representing 3,683 meetings. You will see in here that, you know, how do you know when you either go online when you're somewhere looking for a meeting or you happen to pick up the meeting book, how do you know if the meeting's really there? Have you ever had that happen to you? I was just in North Carolina on business down in High Point, and their meeting finder online gave the date and time of the meeting, and they gave me a meeting finder, and I went to the meeting. There was no meeting there. You know, and that has happened to me. And that happens here in New York City as well. And so what my committee does, and, you know, we only have a group of four or five, the job is to go around and to have the meetings updated so that when you look in the book or you look online, there's a little date. And the date says, when did we last hear from you? So we know when people call, when the sick and suffering alcoholic calls New York Intergroup, or they look us up online on our new meeting finder, we know with confidence that we can send that sick and suffering alcoholic to that meeting. So if any of you, you know, happen to go to other meetings or other boroughs, we could really use the help. You will find us. Sorry, I just had to give that little plug. You will find us here. There's a group relations meeting, the next one. You'll find it in the book. when the next meeting is, and I think it's the second Tuesday in May. The last I'm going to say is that, you know, in my experience, the groups help the sick and suffering alcoholic also by their literature table. I noticed when I came in, I stopped to take a look at your literature table. And so I'm just going to give a little plug, and then my 1 minute is going to be up. And it's through our literature, right, through our conference-approved Alcoholics Anonymous literature, that we continue to help our sick and suffering alcoholic. And why do I say that? Because it doesn't matter if we make money on this literature. In fact, we probably lose money on a regular basis on our grapevine, on our Spanish grapevine. We don't care. We as an organization in Alcoholics Anonymous, the only thing we care about is that our literature helps the sick and suffering alcoholic. There's other literature out there that other people promote, but it's only there if it makes money, or else the publisher will not continue to publish it. That is not us here in Alcoholics Anonymous. So in closing, if you want to know more about the traditions, there's a brand new grapevine book called Our 12 Traditions. It just came out about a year ago. I use that for this. There is the grapevine. This one happens to be keeping AA safe. And that was what our General Service Conference was all about. And lastly, if you haven't seen it, this is the Grapevine Traditions Checklist. And that has a lot of questions on each of the traditions and helped me learn the traditions and how to stay sober one day at a time. So thank you very much for sobriety, and thank you for your group.
And our main speaker tonight is Thomas.
My name is Thomas Sells, and I'm an alcoholic. I am very grateful to join you tonight. My home group is the Pacific Group in Brentwood, California, and I know many of you have visited us. Very rarely on a Wednesday night does not someone stand and introduce themselves and indicate that the Atlantic Group is their home group. Just a few weeks ago, your chair was there, and I got to meet Randy before coming out here. She and her husband were there. I know my sponsor, Clancy, was here a month or so ago in some very inclement weather, so I'm glad you saved the good weather for me. And I am joined tonight by some very dear friends. I know one of your matriarchs here in the Atlantic Group was a member of the Pacific Group and still is when I first got sober, Marlena. And I've always enjoyed the fact that she returns to the Pacific Group to take her cake every year. But my fondest memory of her 30 years ago when I got sober was the way she dressed. When I first saw her, I knew immediately she had an East Coast flair. I've never seen her in flip-flops and a T-shirt. And John and his sponsee from Brazil are here. As my guest tonight, and I see John no matter where I go around the world, somehow or another, he shows up. And then also my fourth guest tonight, which I had to get permission from Randy to go from 2 to 4, is Diana, who got sober in the Pacific Group some 35 years ago, and is now a new staff person at the General Service Office here in New York, and she is now a member of your illustrious group, and I'm grateful that they are here tonight to support me. Now, I did not want to get sober, and probably many of you did not want to get sober either. In fact, I was the last one to know that I actually needed to get sober. Seems like everyone around me understood that need but myself, and I have come to find out that that is a frequent occurrence among us. This is not a social club. It's not a group where we come to learn to line dance. But ironically, when we get here, all of those things do seem to happen. But I had reached the end of my line, and I was desperate. I tried many things. Of course, it's very difficult to lose a best friend, and alcohol was certainly my best friend. And so I thought perhaps I could just change what I was doing, change my drink, go from Maker's Mark to Hennessy, and go from Hennessy to wine, and from wine to beer, and none of those things seemed to be helping me reach my mark. And you know, ironically, one of the first meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous that I attended, there was an old timer there that sort of told my story, because I was just trying to slow down. I did not want to stop. But it seems one night there was a young man driving, inebriated, which was one of my favorite things to do. It was very unusual. If you ever saw me in a car without a cold beer in between my legs, trying to shift gears. But it seems one night this young man drove to the up to the stop sign, and instead of stopping, he just slowed down, which was what I was trying to do. But about halfway through the stop sign, he heard that old familiar anthem. So he pulled to the side. I'm glad there's a few others that know that anthem. I've heard it many times. So he pulled to the side, and the policeman walked up to him, and he said, "Young man," he said, "did you see the stop sign?" He said, "Yeah, I saw it." He said, "Well, why didn't you stop?" He said, "Well, I slowed down. What's the difference?" So he said, "Well, if you'll just step out of the car, I'll try and demonstrate for you what the difference is." And as the young man stepped out of the car, the policeman started hitting him in the head with that billy club in rapid succession. He said, "Bop, bop, bop, bop. Now, do you want me to slow down or do you want me to stop?" And so as the old timer told that story, I related. And so I crawled into Alcoholics Anonymous, beaten into submission, as desperate and as destitute as you could be. As it turns out, the more desperate and the more destitute you are, the greater opportunity you may have to stay sober. I did not understand that. I now know that you don't have to lose every material possession to stay sober, but I did. You don't have to lose the love of every family member or friend that you've ever had in life, but I did. It helped me tremendously to stay here, to be as desperate as I was, because I had nowhere else to go. Now, this was an ironic plot in life, because my father was a Methodist minister for some 50 years before he passed away. My mother was a kind and loving woman to my dad and to all of my siblings. My mom bore 12 of which I am the youngest. Yeah, I hear you. Wow. They don't do that today. And I am the youngest of that brood. I never heard my father curse. I never heard my father raise his voice to my mother. Nor would he have allowed any of my brothers and sisters, because my dad was a big man and he believed in corporal punishment. I never saw a can of beer or a bottle of alcohol in the refrigerator in our home, in the kitchen. Never saw my mom and dad ever take a drink. But my older brothers and sisters figure out how to beat the system. And being the youngest, a precocious, mischievous child, I stayed on their nerves. And they figured out exactly how to get baby Thomas to be quiet. Just give him a drink. Now, I did not understand at that time, that early in my life, of the change in my personality, in my being, that alcohol caused. I just knew that when they gave it to me, I was not bothering them anymore until I actually wanted a little bit more. Now, I'm sure at some point I really began to get on their nerves because I wanted more than what they had. I did not understand that I did not assimilate physically, bodily, alcohol, like most normal people do. Alcohol changed my entire perception of the environment around me. Now, I grew up just across the river here in Newark, New Jersey. Newark, New Jersey was the scariest place I have ever been in my life. And I did not take note that my fear of matriculating around Newark, New Jersey went away under the influence of alcohol. It just seemed like the natural thing. As a PK, as a preacher's kid, that's what they called us when I was growing up. As a PK, we always had trouble in the neighborhood. And alcohol made me so bold until I was willing to do the unthinkable, which is get into a fight in Newark, New Jersey. Because a fight in Newark, New Jersey always involves lots of people. There's no such thing as a one-on-one. Now, I continued to drink as I got older, as often and as frequent as I could, not realizing that I was trying to maintain a certain perception of the world and an ease and comfort in the world that without the influence of alcohol was never a part of my life. But in 1966, I ended up on the front line in Vietnam. I fought the war. I did not watch it. And under the influence of alcohol, it became comfortable for me to do things that I would have never imagined in my life I would have ever done. I remember my first month or so in Vietnam. The command called many of the soldiers in one-on-one and asked us what our beliefs were and whether we had a problem if we were in what's called a free fire zone, if it became necessary to not just take the life of another soldier, but any human being that remained in a free fire zone, which included women and children. And I remember very clearly that I was under the influence during that particular meeting, and I said with some bravado, I have no objections to that at all. But in a more sober moment, I wrote my father, who was a Methodist minister, as I mentioned earlier, about the act of taking human life. And he reminded me that I was in the military, that the country was in the middle of a conflict, and that it was my responsibility to follow orders. I did not make him aware that I did much more than follow orders, that we lived way beyond the precepts and concepts of the Geneva Convention. And the acts that were committed there haunted me constantly. And there seemed to be no one in civilian life able to even deal with the fright and horror and terror that I lived with in my mind. And there were even so few that I was even willing to share it with. And so I constantly stayed inebriated because my only comfort in this world was my dear friend, alcohol. And then my dear friend turned on me. No matter how much I drank, it ceased to work. And life became miserable and painful. I had not heard of Alcoholics Anonymous at the time, but those around me seemed to understand that it would be a place that would be of service to me. Now, life became so pitiful. I know the last time I was arrested, I was going 2 miles an hour in a parking lot. But I was so inebriated that I was unable to gather myself to even represent. I would imagine the police probably thought something of this nature. We don't know what he did, but we know he did something. And they were right. And it seems when I returned from Vietnam, I was always fairly good in academics, and I attended the University of Southern California on a undergraduate scholarship and a graduate fellowship. And the state of California gave me a certified public accountant's license, and I hung it up in Beverly Hills. It was a license to steal. I absolutely disdained you coming into my office if you had a legitimate business, because I was not about legitimate business. While I was a student at Southern California, I had the privilege of meeting a fellow by the name of Noah Dietrich, who at the time was the financial advisor and certified public accountant for Howard Hughes, who was one of the richest men in the world. And so I wanted to follow that model, so I set out to find me a black Howard Hughes. Now, the closest I got to it was a local drug dealer who had a cash flow of about $100,000 a month, and I told him with all sincerity, if you follow my business advice, you will never work again. Now, what I didn't understand was he wasn't working then. And he never paid my invoice in check or cash. He paid it in product, which brought me to you much sooner. So when I crawled through the door, I was like a cat trying to have sex with a skunk. In other words, I didn't get all I wanted, but I got all I could stand. Now, I checked into a rehab not because I wanted to get sober, but I had a bench warrant out for my arrest. And I had heard you people were good fellows. And I had hoped you would do something for me. But that first night you came in, you, because all of the faces are anonymous, members of Alcoholics Anonymous came in on a panel. And there was a young fellow who was who was sober a few years, a former professional athlete, a professional baseball player, and he was telling my story. And I was just desperate and destitute enough to say, would you sponsor me? And I really did not even know what that meant, but he did. So he said, I will sponsor you if you promise to follow my direction. There is no debate. Now, some of you may be under the impression that you're getting suggestions from your sponsor. But you'll find out exactly what it is when you veer off course. Somehow or another, that suggestion actually meant follow it. And so little by little, all I could do in the beginning was stay physically sober. My sponsor told me clearly, he said, Thomas, when you approach the red light and the light is yellow, it does not mean speed up so you can get through the light before it turns red. The yellow means slow down so that by the time you reach the red light, you are at a stop. What a concept. He clearly indicated to me that a 2-ton automobile is not a fair adversary for a human being. In other words, what I was learning was how to stay sober physically. Because I was not at that time really ready to do anything else. And my sponsor spoon-fed me, because I had so many things that had to change. Now, he said to me at the time, you must be willing to change everything. Now, what I heard was, you must change everything. But what I have learned in retrospect is, only the things that are necessary need to change. And that's not an order that cannot be filled. That is something clearly within my power to do. And I began to do it. Now, I saw many things. I saw everyone following the program. People walk to the podium all the time talking about working the steps. Whenever my sponsor heard anyone say the term working the steps, he poked me in the side and he said, you're not going to work the steps. You're going to live them. They're going to be a part of your life. And every decision that you make involves one or more of our complete 36 principles. Either the steps, the traditions, or the concepts. And I began to fall in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. But I also heard you walk to the podium and say, oh, I got sober, I owed the IRS $13,000, and I paid it off. I heard it, but I wasn't talking. I already told you I hung my CPA license. I was a financial advisor to many in the entertainment industry. And I believe I mentioned with a great deal of impropriety. I used to tell my sponsor all the time that I was involved in white-collar crime. And he told me, no, Thomas, you were not involved in white-collar crime. You were an embezzler. But I finally, because I got in so much pain, came clean. And if you are new or old, and you get in pain in this program, that is not the time to leave. You may not understand this now, but pain is the harbinger of change. If you're in pain, that means something good is about to happen for you if you let it. If you understand how this program changes lives and how it touches people inside and out. And so I heard my sponsor say, you know, we are going to do something about it. And when I heard him say we, I figured he was going to help me pay a little bit of this off. So I made my list. As best as I could recall, but I do have to say, as you have heard many times, I'm sure more will be revealed. And over the years, more has been revealed. And gratefully, as more gets revealed, I have been sober long enough to accept the new revelations. And so at about year five, I told my sponsor all about this. I worked up to a number of the first number that I worked at was 469,000. And but I had a great capacity to earn. Now, it hurt because I kind of figured when they gave me those paychecks that it was mine. But my sponsor reminded me, the people you embezzled from, they don't want your money. They want their money back. But when I turned 10, I was free. And I'm telling you, freedom inside your soul is worth more than any level of bank account. In fact, there are many lessons that I learned sober, which never crossed my mind before I got sober. And one of them was, if you actually ever want to save money, no matter what your earning power is, live below your means. And you will always have something left over to put away. And to contribute to Alcoholics Anonymous. I have heard many people, not here tonight, but I have heard many people talking about donating to Alcoholics Anonymous. You do not donate to your home. This is where we live. We contribute. And we make everything possible. Now, I became also very painfully aware that physical sobriety is certainly not enough. You move at your own pace, I moved at mine. My sponsor told me it would be necessary for me to begin to pray. Now, my normal prayer was all about, give me, let me, have you got to spare. It's all about me. And he told me, point blank, you are to never utter another prayer in your life that asks for something for yourself. Your prayers, the result of them should always be, now this is my sponsor talking to me. I'm not telling you this. You got sponsors. My sponsor told me, whatever you ask for, if it does not result in being useful to your fellows, don't ask for it. So, I asked for a Cadillac so I could take newcomers to meetings. There you go. Now, I told you my father was a Methodist minister. And in my home, spirituality and religious principles were always practiced. But I was not a believer. I did not bring the God of my father into this program. But I understood, as I watched your lives flourish, the necessity of having a higher power in my life. And so particularly when I reached 22 years sober, I began to honestly and sincerely wish for a higher power to come into my soul. And since that time, my days have been unbelievably wonderful. And I have tried to pattern my life following the very frequently said serenity prayer that we all say here. And so I ask for the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, which is you. I have no power over you. I care for you, but I cannot make you change. But I did ask for the courage to change the things I can, which is me. And the wisdom to know the difference, which essentially is tending to my business, leaving yours alone. Thank you.